Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is him.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same.
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. Yeah, this is Tech Talk. This is Michael Tech Talk Kessler, and we're on WRLR. And I think I'm not positive. Did the free CD of 100 free hours of AOL work for you, Dave?
I'm here.
Hey, there he is. All right.
I'm.
I apologize. I should have sent it as in floppy format, so that it would work on your machine. But all I had were the CDs that.
No, I'm very, very sad. I've been a victim of cyberbullying.
Yes, yes, it's true. It's true. Yeah. We've been beating Dave up online. I have to. good morning. Good morning. But what we're talking about, of course, is that it turns out a lot of people are still using AOL.
Yeah. Welcome to Tech Talk, everybody. what's actually happened is a good friend of mine, somebody I thought was a friend, posted on my timeline, not even on his own timeline or on the Tech Talk timeline, that 2 million people are still using AOL dial-up or paying for it anyway, whether they're using it or not. I've been outed as one of those 2 million people that is still stuck in the internet stone age.
Now, you're not using dial-up, though, just to be fair and clear. You do not do dial-up. You've got a regular somewhat high speed bandwidth connection.
I've been found out. You found me out. Now everybody knows that I use AOL dial-up.
Does that even exist anymore? Really? I mean, it seems crazy to me. I haven't done a dial-up to anything, and I don't even recall when. It has to be 10 years. No, 8 years probably. Yeah, I don't know, something like that. No, you're not actually using dial-up though. Please clarify that for us. Just, are you really using dial-up right now?
I'm not saying.
No, dude. You know, we used to have a running joke when I was managing IT for in Displains. We were saving those floppies, and we were going to have unlimited internet forever.
Oh yeah, that was the thing. Remember, you could change your username.
Yes.
And get a new account because. How much? What were the time limits early on? Was it 10 hours a month or something? Or,
well, so at one point, in fact, when dial-up was really starting to die, they started putting them out as 100 hours, 100 free hours. Now, 100 free hours, of course, you know, at 56K. You try to download that first episode of House of Cards or something, you know, and you're pretty much done right there. That's your 100 hours.
That was pretty slow. And our good old friend Tom Stoller, who used to be the morning man at WRLR, he chimed in with, "Oh, I just got a brand new dual band router."
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, though, and we were talking about 56K modems. His router probably cost less than that 56K modem did back in the day.
You're probably right. I remember, you know, my first one. Yeah, when I, you know, in fact, I'm trying to remember. So I remember having the 28.8, and there was like a 33 in between the 28 and the 56. People don't remember that because it wasn't around for very long because the 28 was there and then the 33, and it was like, oh, that's kind of cool. But literally like a month or two later, all of a sudden the 56Ks were out. And U.S. Robotics was just pumping those things out like nobody's. I mean, it was like hotcakes. They were selling like hotcakes. And
friends of mine, they. I had a 14.4, and for my birthday or something, they bought me a 28.8.
Wow.
And then
You like within nice a month,
I bought a 56. I felt really bad. I had to conceal it from him. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, geez. Well, things were changing so quickly at that time too. You know, in the days of you know, just being so excited to go down. I remember. I think it was like it was an off day usually too, because I think they used somebody else's presses to save money. But it was like Tuesday nights or something like that. I could go down to the corner where the newspaper stand was, and you'd get the local Chicago computer bulletin, and that would have at the back of it just pages and pages and pages of local BBSs and the phone numbers with them. And so you get that and you get excited, go back and start dialing all these numbers and seeing which ones actually went someplace cool that you could do anything at.
Yeah. You know what? I miss those PC Shopper magazines. Boy, I used to, you know, they were thick. They were like small phone books.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And boy, to tear through those things and look at, you know, just thrilled at every new advance, every new geek toy that came out.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That was exciting. That was exciting stuff. I remember that too, and you know, and that was useful too. Then you had this 2.5-inch thick wad of disposable paper. Great for when you went camping. You know, you take, oh, like, yeah, I got a stack of these from last year. Let's take them camping. You know, we got firewood and kindling all in one. We're all set.
Well, what a cash cow that must have been. We used to, you know, there was nothing but ads. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have like 10 or 15 articles in this thing. It was hundreds of pages. And we paid for it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Basically, you paid for somebody to sell you stuff. Yeah. Speaking of which, so the article I'm reading about this, about the 2 million people paying for their dial-up, it's on CNET, and they have it aside and a link out to another news article you might have or have not seen, but... A California man, this is just recently, just like a week and a half ago, wound up getting a $24,000 AT&T bill for his phone. And why is that? Because he had AOL dial-up and didn't realize that it connected at some point.
Oh, no.
He was probably downloading that episode of House of Cards I was talking about. You know, it got done somewhere near the end of the month, and you know, $24,000 later, he was ready to go. Now they wound up; they did have mercy on him. All credit due to AT&T or AOL. I don't know who talked them into it, but they did drop the bill so that he didn't have to pay $24,000.
Wow, can you imagine? Talk about geek shame. That would be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm just lucky it didn't happen to me.
You know? I do remember making those mental calculations of, you know, when you were getting charged for phone use by the minute, local phone use by the minute. It was like, oh man, you know, this is a 773 number, but I'm calling out to 847. How much is that going to cost me? You know.
I can remember very clearly having all the I had all the locations, you mm-hmm. know, of the nearby modem farms, whatever. I can't even remember what they were called, but. You know, they had various locations you could dial into to try and save the toll charges and such.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's exactly right. I forgot about that. Yeah. Where they would be connected out to other places and all that and save you some money. And I, not coincidentally, I don't know, worked for a company that actually did something similar, but with faxing. So you could send a document into their centralized servers and it would broadcast fax all these pages and pages of whatever it was you were trying to connect with other people and save a couple of bucks one way or the other on that. So
I used to follow the cable guys around. When I'd see a cable truck, I'd like curb them. I'd follow them and wait till they got where they were going. They'd get out of their truck. Hi, when's cable internet coming?
Yeah.
Into this neighborhood. Have you heard anything? You know, Or when a new ISP provider, internet service provider, would come in, I remember there was a company called Interact, and they've changed their name. They're a big cable company in Chicago. I can't remember their name right now, but when they first started up, they had a little bit faster service or whatever. I signed up with them right away. And they started out. They were in an apartment in the Lakeview neighborhood in the Wrigleyville area, And I went in, and there was like gear everywhere, all and wires all over the floor, and all that. And I signed up. I was customer number 39.
Ooh, wow!
That was my number for years. I was customer. Whenever I called up and I had an issue, they'd be like, "Oh, you're one of the early guys," you know.
that's well, and I mean, and your AOL address is Dave. 1-2, isn't it, at AOL.com, something like that?
I wish I'd thought of that at the time. I wish I thought of having something much simpler than I did, actually.
Dave 007.
Who knew that would become such a premium?
A thing. I mean,
who knew this, the internet thing would take off?
Yeah. Well, you know, and that was, I remember thinking that now more recently for those, you know, the younger crew here. Same thing was happening with Twitter. And I remember... when I signed up for Twitter, and I was fairly early on, but not super.
Oh, I remember very clearly when you did. I thought you were nuts.
Yeah, everybody did.
Oh, gee, this guy, how big is this guy's ego that he's got?
He's got to have a Twitter account. I know, but I was bummed because, and I knew it, you know, but somebody had already taken michael@twitter.com and mike@twitter.com. And then I like delayed it a little while because I still was thinking, oh, well, this Twitter thing's going to die soon. Anyways, by the time I got in there, techtalk@twitter.com was gone too. And I had to settle for techtalk WRLR, you know, and which is fine. I know that's okay too. I'm proud of that connection.
Well, I remember when we first started talking about Twitter. It's like we were giving these poor guys a break by talking about them on the air.
And now there you go. And then Uber is of course another one of the startups. And I just heard a recent report that they are on track, they think right now, to be one of the fastest earning startups of this size or something along those lines. They're also just doing very, very well. And Tesla now has got, we were talking about the new battery that he's Elon Musk, the Powerwall, that is as expected. I expected nothing less. It's doing very, very well. They've actually received more than 38,000 reservations for the Powerwall already, and that includes about 2,800 businesses that want to purchase the commercial version called the Power Pack. Now the Power Pack is a pack of two, I believe, because you can actually expand. This is very expandable, these power packs, and you can just keep building one off of the other off of the other. They go for somewhere between $300 to $3,500 a piece, and then you connect them together and you put them in your house or your business, and it can store energy. Either you can do a couple of different really cool things with it. They're smart enough. You can not only store energy from your renewable energy sources. So if you've got solar panels on your roof or whatever it may be, boom, those will be right in there. And so you can use the energy from them at any time you want to and save yourself a few bucks. But you can also, too, load those batteries up at the times when your electrical costs are the lowest, because typically you're charged less for electricity at night than you are during peak times. So, yes. So you can do that. And of course, you can even make some money back. Some areas allow you to feed the grid. They'll let you push electricity back into the grid when you're not using it and get a little money back as well. So
yeah, and theoretically that can help stabilize the grid, right? Because we wouldn't have as much require, you know, the grid doesn't have to be as robust, right? If people have storage for peak times, their own storage, then they don't need to rely on the grid's maximum capacity.
Yeah.
This sounds great, but I guess in Hawaii, and I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately, but in Hawaii, there's solar energy is very popular there. But it's changing. It's disrupting the conventional grid infrastructure and financial resources and such, because people, you know, they don't know how to manage that. They don't know how to manage. If everybody's, you know, getting solar power, then what happens to the grid?
Yeah, well, and that's an interesting thing. It was kind of what I was going to bring up. I hadn't heard that happening in Hawaii, so that's interesting. I'm going to have to look that up. But when you were just talking a second ago about, you know, pulling that energy, pushing it into the grid, making the grid more robust, that was exactly what I was going to mention, is that what would be, of course, wonderful and utopian, the ideal, would be that the grid would ultimately, you'd have perhaps these large power plants, but they wouldn't be the necessity that they are today, that you would actually have everyone that's got energy sources, whether it be solar or whatever, pumping into the grid, make the grid more you know, really peer to peer, as opposed to having to go through these centralized, places. And now, you know, heck, you can, as long as that energy is transferable, as long as it's transportable. And I think that's going to be maybe one of the bigger next hurdles for really expanding the grid in the way that I'm envisioning it. There'd be no reason why you couldn't really exist for a lot longer in a lot better way without having to, without having that ultra reliance on the public utility and the electrical utility.
This Powerwall concept makes it possible for people to get off the grid.
Yeah,
completely. You know, if you want to make the investment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's coming up with newer ways to, help people finance that and things like this. And I know there's been, of course, in the past, some benefits just for your taxes if you invest in, better savings for energy and better savings for insulation and things like that, that'll reduce your needs, reduce your electrical needs. That's all a good thing. I'm going to, before we bring in Jay, there's a few things, of course, to talk about with Jay. I don't know that he'll have much.
You should definitely bring Jay in early today. First of all, I'm hungry, always hungry for geek trivia.
Absolutely.
Want to hear Jay's geek trivia, but his trivia question from last week is going to generate a lot of discussion between the two of you.
Yeah. But before I get into that, I was going to bring up very quickly, because this will apply. I think you have more interest in this, perhaps, than J.B. Rowley, more interest than me, even, as I'm not necessarily into the whole music broadcasting thing. But there has been a lot of back and forth and discussion recently about this sort of battle over songwriters versus song performers and streaming services versus terrestrial radio. And especially now, as organizations such as WRLR, for example, are kind of crossing that divide and being both a terrestrial radio resource, you know, where you can tune your dial in physically to, attune all the crystals to get the to get that wave function happening.
I was just reading about how to do that this morning. I built a crystal set when I was a kid, but there was somebody, some guy is talking about how to salvage the parts from a broken TV or a TV that's been discarded to make a crystal type radio.
Oh, well, that would be a fun weekend project. That would be kind of cool. Oh man. But things have evolved a lot, of course, since then, and you've got the internet stuff. The WRLR app is actually, it's out there right now. It hasn't officially, there's not an official release and in advertisement for it, but if you go, you can actually, don't tell anybody, but secret, if you go search on the Google Play Store or Amazon under WRLR, you'll find the app, and now you can listen to it anywhere on the internet.
Wow, that's so cool.
It's there. It's out there.
So it's sort of like a secret bootleg thing right now.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, we're kind of not unofficially official in beta testing it. So far it seems to be working pretty well. We've got a couple of dozen downloads already. And
that's very exciting.
It's doing okay.
Very, very exciting.
It's doing okay.
Wow, a whole new age has begun. This is just like when Twitter first started.
I think it is. Join now. Send me a note, and I'll reserve your, Dave at WRLR. Android app streaming live something. I don't know what we're calling it. But yeah. You don't want to be Dave 19732 at what I was saying, so we're streaming audio, we're streaming radio, and this is a very common thing. We have, we're a 501c3, we've got all the licensing and FCC regulations and all that behind us to do that, and it's great for us and it's great for listeners. But unfortunately, there's a lot of frustration, I think, because of course songwriters and song producers have seen their potential revenues drop dramatically, and you know, the payments from digital streaming services have been regularly posted as, you know, very just shockingly small, you know, pennies, you know, for thousands of plays, literally.
WRR, we pay licensing fees every year.
Oh, yes, we do. Oh, yes, we do.
Yeah. And because of our not-for-profit status, they're not huge, but we do pay. And we believe in artists being compensated. And some of the streaming services artists are complaining that they're not getting a big enough piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and there's something to be said for that as well. And so things are starting to change. I think it's changing the market a little bit, finally. And what I'm hearing recently is that the publishers of music now are basically deciding that they're going to sidestep the middleman, sidestep the record labels. They're going to publish and create and produce music and then work directly and negotiate directly with the streaming services, which is what the record labels have been doing for them up to this point. And that's been part of the pain, I think, is that when you've got so many people involved in the mix, there's less to trickle down, you know, down to the guys that are actually doing stuff. So,
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Yeah. And Pandora's buying,
you know, if the streaming services were smart, they could be like Netflix and create their own content, right? They could be the new record labels.
You know, that would be interesting. I think that's a better way to describe it, is that they would be the record labels, so they would hire artists specifically to create content for their services. I think that would be interesting. You know, there was the Katy Perry debacle where she said, you know, no Spotify, I'm not going to do it. You can't play my music on Spotify. Now, that would have been an interesting resolution to that, is to have a Pandora or someone call her up and say, look, yeah, forget about Spotify. Come join us. Come to the dark side. We'll pay you whatever, yeah, you know, but we'll have a percentage cut on your next two albums, but we're going to support you to do that. And, you know, it's same thing's happening, of course, with, as we've talked about in the past, with the ebooks and stuff as well. So that'll be, you know what, let me bring our good friend Mr. Garman in, though. I just wanted to, like I said, I wasn't sure if he'd be on that one.
Jay Garman. he posted on Facebook that last week was Derby weekend, of course.
Yes.
And he said and it busted his diet. I mean, he you know, he indulged for the weekend.
All of
despite that, he still continues to lose weight.
Hello.
That's why everybody hates Jay. Oh, wait. Oh, so, hey. We were talking about the bragging on Facebook of the I completely blew my diet, but somehow still managed to lose weight. The comment that did.
I regret nothing.
nor should you. Absolutely. No, that's good. You know what that shows? That shows that it's working right. That you're doing it right. You're not just changing your diet, but you're changing your system and your metabolism, and hopefully maybe even adding a little bit of muscle. Muscle burns a lot more calories, people don't realize, than anything else. That's one of the best ways to lose weight by exercise, is not through cardio, but pumping up, getting jacked.
Well, I'm mostly only doing cardio. I run about, you know, 15K a week. So that's about all the exercise I really get. Plus, you know, I have the 3-year-old around, which is a lot like doing weight training in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. Just wait till she's five, you know. Gets even more fun. Yeah, no, and that's a cool thing. Now, this is a wonderfully connected world that we live in, because I do see when you take a run, because we are friends on Runkeeper, and you use Runkeeper a lot. I use Runkeeper intermittently, but I do get a note every time Jay takes that run. I have another friend as well that inspires me, who's out there even in the wintertime. He's got his, you know, 2.5-3 miles. He's not necessarily doing marathons, but just getting it done. And I think that's so cool, not only that you're doing it and to see you doing it, but that it gives me that kind of, you know, planted kick right in the butt to say, hey, I got to get out there too and start doing this.
Well, I appreciate that I'm of use to you, and I like occasionally seeing you on there. The problem is the people who got me onto Runkeeper are my friends in Boston, where Runkeeper's actually designed. And a couple of them, one, Ryan Harnedy in particular, who never listens to this podcast, so I'll call him out, who works in channel sales at Carbonite. He runs the Boston Marathon, and his mile time is about 8:10 for the Boston Marathon. I kind of hate his living gut.
Yeah, I have had a tough time with that too, Dave. I mean, Jay, I was late to fitness myself, and I was very proud. Here's my little personal story here. I was doing about everything bad for yourself you could picture, as far as smoking. I was about 50 pounds overweight. Also more than that probably, but just all sorts of craziness going on, and I finally got to a point where I said enough is enough. I was eating terribly, of course, all this good stuff, and I wound up, I did it. I started running, I started working out, I changed my diet, I quit smoking, all pretty much at the same time. I dropped around 50-55 pounds, never felt better, doing great, and the thing that was so tough though for me is I'm like, oh, I'm such a superstar now, but I am so brutally slow. I'll run. I've done it. I've done half marathons, and I'm never going to be. And I see people twice my weight out there just chugging away like freight trains and going twice my speed. And I don't know what to do about that.
Well, I'm sure that there are people out there who could advise you on how to up your pace, but I think some of us, Mike, are just stuck in the right-hand lane, and that's just how it's going to be.
Yeah.
We have other stats buffed up on the character sheet, and speed is just not going to be one of them.
Yes. Yeah, I guess, and that's kind of how I look at it, and I'm okay with it now. It took me some time to really be okay with that, but I'm okay with it now. It's all right,
And it's not a video game. You don't have to get a high score. It's about quality of life, right?
Well, once you add Runkeeper to it, and I've got my Gear Fit watch on, and now it is a video game. I need more points. I gotta beat Jay.
what's that game I heard that's for runners where the zombies are chasing you?
Run Zombie Run. Yeah, I keep debating whether to invest. You know what? I've actually got some extra Google Play dollars because I got gifted some. Maybe I should get that. So, Run Zombie. And Jay, you were involved in the Zombie Run in Louisville, I know, which was an actual physical thing that was happening. But they do have an app for your phone called, I think it's called Run Zombie Run. And it costs you a couple of bucks, but it basically plays through your headphones. You can be listening to your regular music, but kind of like Runkeeper will pipe in and say, 5 minutes elapsed, you're running such and such a pace, da da da. It will pipe in and say, look out, there's zombies right behind you. And it's time to go, and you gotta kick it up a bit.
Yeah, the only reason I haven't invested in that is I haven't gone and gotten a phone upgrade. And my current phone, the Galaxy S3, as much as it tries, can barely handle running Runkeeper and Pandora at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's I don't think I could have put a third overlay app on that where I'm listening to music and Runkeeper and because I want to track my fitness in Runkeeper and also track the whole zombie thing. My wife has used it a couple of times and she says it's fun the first two or three and then it gets old because it's just like when it senses your pace is slowing down, like, oh no, zombies, and then it'll just play the moaning in the background. And you pick up your pace. It's like, after a while, it's like, just let them catch me. I'm done with this. just let them catch me.
and sadly, if there was a zombie apocalypse, that would probably be my attitude, too. After a certain, it'd be like, I'm too tired. I'm going to eat some Cheetos. I've come get me. I was a little concerned about that. You did hit on a point, though, too, that's been a little problematic for me recently. So I was, in full credit out and credit due, I was given a Samsung Galaxy Fit or a Gear Fit, not given it, but allowed to use it for a little while here to test out from our good friends at Verizon, and which is exciting, which is cool. I'd been kind of wanting to get into some of the more advanced wearables for a while. So very, very pleased with it. it. The only thing that is a little tough for me is I'm a big time Runkeeper user also. You can't do it. You can't do both the Samsung Fit app and Runkeeper to track your stuff at the same time. You can't connect the two of them either. So you have to kind of decide which way you're going to go. And, in interest of doing an appropriate a test and analysis for a review, ultimately, I've been using strictly the Samsung Fit app and the Samsung Gear app, and then that's one of the things that I'll have to knock them on. Like I said, I'm generally very pleased, but I'll have to knock them on it. Is just like, why would you not let it connect with what you're already using? You know, I don't know why. I don't know. People want to lock things in, you know, and that just hasn't worked all that well. Apple notwithstanding, but.
I have a number of Samsung devices, and they're all great devices. I don't have a smartwatch from them yet. But every single one of them has a quote-unquote Samsung account on it. My Galaxy S3, I got a couple of TVs, and so on and so forth. And they all want the same thing that I have, like with an iCloud account or a Google account or a Facebook account. Like, I'm sorry, you're Samsung. You don't get to have that. It's not. I know you desperately want that to be true, that you have the same federated identity system as every other big cloud player. You make hardware, okay?
Yes.
And the way you're going to get my business is when the hardware plays with my existing software accounts. I'm not going to give up Gmail because you make a good TV. That's not happening.
Yep. Oh, exactly. And that was why, like, the Microsoft RT tablet that I've got, the Surface RT that I've got, is essentially collecting dust sitting in a corner, because Microsoft did the same thing. They're like, well, if you're going to use this, you got to use all Microsoft stuff all the time. We're not going to give you a Gmail app. We're not going to give you a Google anything. And so you're stuck. And that means, well, then I'm not going to use you.
Well, and that's generally what's happened. So, I mean, the good thing is that Samsung has sort of come around, and I can't, you know, it's an Android phone. I can get anything I want on it. And I will give them credit. They have actually gotten much better. So when I first got my Samsung Smart TV and I had a Galaxy S3, I could do something called screen mirroring. I still can, where anything that was on the screen of my Samsung, I could put on the screen of my Samsung TV. Phone and TV could look exactly the same, which was a great way before ESPN3 lets you get on a lot of TVs. I could put ESPN3 on my TV. But in the interim, one, ESPN3 has come around and lets you put things on other devices, and Samsung is now, all the Samsung Smart TVs are natively Chromecast compatible. So when I hit the Chromecast key, it looks for my Smart TV without me having to physically put a Chromecast on it, which I think is a brilliant move.
Oh,
and they should
cool.
do more things like that.
Very cool. I did not realize that. I didn't know that. Now, I do have a Chromecast, so mine typically, yeah, it just goes to the Chromecast. I've got Chromecast and Roku's. I don't have any Samsung TVs, so that that also has never, it's never come up for me. We are a Samsung family. I've got to confess, too. We've got a 3, a 4, and a 6, and a Note 4, and then, of course, the Gear Fit Watch here that I've got as well. So it's, I didn't realize we have a surprising number of Samsung devices. Oh, and even my wife's Chromebook is a Samsung Chromebook, now that I think of it. Oh man, I gotta buy.
You bought a pricey Chromebook. The Samsung ones are not the low end models, Chief.
Oh, well, this one was. It was one of their lower models, and it was on sale.
You got one of the last cheap Chromebooks they made, because Samsung has basically decided, as long as this becomes the Samsung Review Hour, that they are out of the low-end business.
Yes.
That they are a premium electronics manufacturer. And I'm not going to fight them on this, because they have made the two best televisions I've ever bought. I've had no problem with my Samsung phones. They've all been great. I got no complaints about any of that. But basically, at this point, it's like, if you're not willing to drop $1,500 on a laptop, you can't have a Samsung laptop. Like, that's the floor for them now.
Wow. Well, even for the Chromebooks, though? Because, I mean, that prices them out of the market. Their Chromebooks can't be that much. Because I think we paid, this was one of the lower-end ones, but it was like one. Or are you saying Samsung's not doing Chromebooks anymore? Is that it?
No, Samsung's doing Chromebooks. Samsung's doing the high-end, like, Pixel type Chromebooks that are like supposed to compete with MacBook Airs that have solid state drives and cold boot. Like they're in that end of the Chromebook market now, where you're going to drop $1,500, $2,000 on a Chromebook because it's, you know, got a 37-year battery life and cold boots and has four USB-C ports and is made out of, you know, etched titanium and is razor sharp and can be wielded as a samurai weapon. Like those kind of Chromebooks is what they're into now. Yeah. The $200 given to everybody in your fifth grade class Chromebooks, they ain't got no interest no more.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, and that's kind of the thing that I like about the Chromebooks, though, is they're essentially disposable. You know, you drop it or you spill some coffee on it and it's like, yeah, it's painful. You know, but it's kind of also like, oh well, you know, get a new one and put it in.
It's the price of the right kind of Chromebook is the price of a decent tablet. It's not the price of a crappy car.
Yes,
that's sort of like where I think a Chromebook price point should be. But clearly, there are some Chromebooks on the market that are trying to get in the hipster crowd, which I find hilarious. Mm-hmm. And part of me is just totally convinced, as a guy who works for a software company where a lot of folks have Macs for absolutely no good reason other than to say they have Macs, that they have decided that they're going to do a Chromebook equivalent of that, so that the whatever the hipster CFO has to have or the hipster chief marketing officer, if they go to an all Chromebook rollout, they can still have the snazzy one.
That's right. That's right. They get have the tricked out Chromebook. Oh man, it's kind of like putting you know, fins and a flame job on your Yugo. It's, you know, you wipe all that away. It's still a Yugo. It and it still does what it's supposed to, which is get you somewhere. And you know, and again, that's kind of what I see is the beauty of the Chromebooks. You know, I would sort of right now I do see, though, I think the next time I do think we will buy another Chromebook in our family. I think, though, that if I do, I'll probably be willing to spend a little more, not Samsung money more, but a little bit more. The main thing is just to get away from the extremely cheap feel of those chiclet keyboards. I just can't stand those. They just really bug me. And my Vio that I've got, that I've had for years, also has a chiclet style keyboard, but it's a little, I don't know, it has a better feel to it. But I also too just don't use it that much. So, I don't know. I'm heavy into Linux, though. I've got a Raspberry Pi now too at home, and that's running Debian. And then I've got my Vio, which I completely converted. I haven't touched and used on a regular basis either Windows or Chrome for a very long time. Very long time.
Really? Well, I am impressed with you. I am in a place, we've had this conversation before, where we cannot give up Microsoft Office in my household. I can't give it up because I have some very specific, as an occasional professional writer, things I have to have out of Word. Mm-hmm. And my wife, as a social worker, deals with government agencies where they send her forms in Microsoft Word that can never, ever, ever, ever be converted away from Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
They have to stay Microsoft all the time. They can't be converted to a Google Doc. They can't go to OpenOffice. They've got to stay absolutely perfectly formatted and in the Google Docs file type. I mean, sorry, Word file type always.
Yeah.
Or to blow up whatever god-awful SharePoint contraption they have to submit it to.
And unfortunately, with those, even with the online Office, the Office 365, some of those complex forms, they just, you know, you can't even use them in Microsoft's version of the world. So, yeah, that, you know, we don't have anything like that going on. And also, too, of course, I'm involved very heavily with education and educational technology, and everybody's moving towards the Google stuff. So that's making it a lot easier. You know, the people that I deal with now, when they're in the school districts, that's always the first question is, can I just share you my Google Doc? Is that okay? And most of the time it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, Google, as someone who's worked for a company that and still consults for a company that backs up Google Apps domains, that pleases me to hear. But I think it also very much comes down to the fact that Google basically gives Google Apps for Education away, like almost entirely for free, which I think is a very smart move because all those kids are going to grow up, and when they're ready to start their businesses, they're going to go, what am I used to using? Oh, that's right, Google Apps. And off they go. It's almost Trotskyite, and it's it's devilishness.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's how Apple snuck in on Tandy Radio Shack, was the same exact thing. Tandy had a lock on the Ed market back in the early days there, and Apple came in and basically started giving stuff away. And that was it. Before you knew it, most colleges and schools had Apples, and you know it works. It's a good way to go. Now Microsoft is also dropping the price of their devices anyways. They're talking about putting out basically Chromebook priced full-blown Windows machines. They also, too, I mentioned the Raspberry Pi earlier. There is coming out very shortly here a version of Windows 10 that will run on the Raspberry Pi and that they're going to offer for free. So I can see that just blowing up in the Ed market very easily. Those two pieces, if it's done right. If you're used to using Microsoft, why wouldn't you just keep using Microsoft if the cost is about the same? It just wouldn't make sense to switch.
Exactly. Well, Microsoft has basically had to go away from premium to freemium model, which is where all their competitors were for so long, but there are now so many competitors, they have to be there too. And for those who don't know what freemium is, it's free to a point, at which point if you want to unlock extended features, then you pay. Most games you get on your mobile device are this way now. Well, that's the future of it is the present of Microsoft Office. There's Microsoft Office Starter Edition. There's free online versions of the Office 365 version of Microsoft Office. But you can only go so far and do so much, and then they want you to pay. And that, I think, is the right way to go with Windows coming out soon. I think Windows 10 will probably be the last version, if not that, then the second to last version of Windows, where there is not a free starter version for everyone all the time.
Yeah.
Where there is some OEM, you just get it no charge, and if you want to throw in some extra modules like Media Center or you know something else where it upscales for a corporate environment or high-end performance, then you got to pay. But basic kernel OS, free.
Yep. Yeah, well, and I mean, and that's, it's been wonderful. It's been so exciting to see Satya Nadella come in, taking over for Ballmer and completely changing the way that Microsoft operates and really doing it right. I mean, they just really have come in and made that change in their whole paradigm of how they approach the marketplace, and it's working for them. It's taking a little while to really happen, but it's working for them.
Well, what blew Microsoft up was until about, I'm going to say, 2001, the cost of computers were so prohibitive that the place most people encountered them were at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so Microsoft had a lock on the corporate environment. We all know how their pricing schemes work to make it more affordable for corporations to buy it. And their whole design scheme was Microsoft does everything. You never get fired for buying Microsoft. They stole that from the IBM playbook. And their strategy was if you mostly use computers at work and every time you went to work you use Windows, when it came time for you to buy a personal computer, you would buy what you were used to. Computers have subsequently gotten cheap enough and diverse enough that the reverse is now true, that most people, the first computer they get, they either see at school or they buy personally. My kids had computers or access to them before they ever started school.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how Apple had their comeback, is we're going to make computers that are unbelievably fun and easy to use, or computer-like devices like the iPhone and the iPad that are so easy to use that when you go to work, you will demand that your employer, if they want to get most productivity out of you, use tools with which you are already familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And Microsoft has basically had to get Ballmer out of the building before they could accept that reality.
Yep. It's true. And, you know, it is funny, and I was having this similar conversation recently, is that, you know, we're seeing that happen, of course, the other way around as well, is that working in education, the kids come home now and they've got the Chromebooks. And when they're progressing along, they're bugging their parents to get Chromebooks as well, because that's what they're comfortable with. But there is enough of an interface change and enough of a sort of understanding how things come together in the background to make it tough for some of the late adopters and the old, the older people to really get a handle on how to use Google, how to use Chromebooks effectively. I see it with my wife. I see it with people that I talk to as well. And I'm too entrenched in it sometimes myself to really understand how much of an uphill battle that is. Just the idea that like, oh, wait a second, when I click on this folder icon here, I'm seeing both things that are right here on my machine and also ones that are out on the internet everywhere and don't impact my storage and also too, you know, could be shared or whatever. That in itself is just a difficult concept for some people to get, and something that the younger kids, the people who have been using Google for a long time, it doesn't even occur to them to wonder where the file is in reality, because it does not matter. But that's a tough concept to get across to people that are entrenched in that kind of older file cabinet, iconography.
Well, and to be honest, the whole notion of physically moving a file has been an intellectual abstract that has been wrong from day one. You are never actually physically moving anything through a pipe. This is not water. These are not a series of tubes. You are copying from one place to another. And that's what you're doing even when you move things. You don't ever physically move anything on your machine. You change a file prefix so that it scans your whole hard drive, it moves. I think we're finally getting to a point where we're going to have to educate kids on actually how information storage works, because these abstractions are breaking down further and further and further to where they're not useful anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we're still showing old, you know, 1.44 floppy disks that represents a save button or, you know, celluloid film canisters to show video recording. And, like, that's completely archaic. And they that's a save button. I don't know why it's a save button, but it clearly is one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it'd be equivalent to, having to still listen to the modem connection sound when you fire up Internet Explorer, which I know, Dave, you still do that, right?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Hey, you guys.
I know we're getting close.
If you don't get the trivia pretty soon, you're going to have to preempt the whole rest of the day at the station.
And we were going to talk the whole time about pseudoscience and goofiness and anti-vaxxers and stuff. And instead, we got off on this other tangent. So Jay, speaking of pseudoscience and all the other good stuff, so what was the geek trivia question and answer for the day?
So 35 years ago today, actually, the World Health Organization declared that smallpox had been eradicated.
Yay.
But it had actually they said the disease was completely gone. But that was not it had actually been several years since anyone had been diagnosed with smallpox. So the question was, who was the last person to catch naturally occurring smallpox in the wild, and what were the unusual factors around his contraction of the disease?
Yeah.
And the answer is Ali Mael Ma'alim, which I forgive you or forgive me if I pronounce that incorrectly or you didn't understand it, who was a Somalian. And what was interesting is that he contracted the disease as part of one of the immunization teams who went out. He was actually a cook in a hospital in Somalia and was also part of the teams that went out into the wilderness and did smallpox vaccinations. And he lied when they said, "Have you been vaccinated?" He said, "No." He said, "Yes, I have," even though he had not. And he had not because, quote, "the shots looked like they hurt."
not because he had autism, but because just that the I had to stick that in there somewhere. I remember hearing about it. Now, and of course, too, recently now, big news came out that we have eradicated rubella, at least in the U.S. Now, of course, worldwide, it's still a factor. And again, because we have these vaccinations. But if people aren't vaccinating, guess what? You can still get stuff, even if it's theoretically gone. Smallpox, though, now exists only in the laboratories, which is awesome.
It is, in fact, very awesome. And also I want to point out that even though Miley was the last person diagnosed, he also had there were two strains of smallpox, major and minor. And minor was the less deadly, and that's what he got. The last person who got variola major actually occurred in 1975, a Bangladeshi girl named Rahima Banu, who is still alive, married, and has four children. So even though she contracted this deadly disease, she was, you know, tracked down as part of the vaccination effort, got proper medical care, and survived, and is you know, went on to have a long life. So medicine works, people.
Yeah.
Yes. Use it.
If you use it, exactly. If you use it, it does. It does. Well, and it's been really interesting. I know we don't have a ton of time here, but it's been really interesting to see recently somewhat of a backlash against these, you know, for want of a better word, the snake oil salesmen and the kind of these vectors of misinformation, including the Dr. Oz's of the world and your Jenny McCarthy's and Vane Hare and, you know, all these people like this. There's no alleged about it. There's nothing alleged. I'm sorry. There's no two sides to this story, Dave. I do not accept that.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just trying to protect your bank account.
If Dr. Oz sues me, he's welcome to you know, whatever paltry sum he can, because it would promote me so heavily. I'd be very happy, Dr. Oz. Before you become just Mr. Oz, invite me on your show, and I'd be more than happy to talk to you about this issue. But it is kind of.
I hope when you were attending Northwestern, you made some friends at the law school.
I actually have more lawyer friends now than ever before. Now that I'm on the school board, it's funny. they're all coming around. I read a really interesting article that said, I think this is in the Atlantic, saying that it may be time and may be done that things are starting to finally shift. And it's kind of a Yogi Berra sort of deal that the pseudoscience train is coming to a stop. Nobody wants to get on anymore because it's too popular now. It used to be this sort of elite signal to say, oh, I don't vaccinate my children, or I'm going to only eat grass root for the next 6 months because paleo something. You know, these things now have become so mainstreamed and so flyover state middle America soccer mom kind of thing that the Gwyneth Paltrows and the Jenny McCarthy's that had been promoting it previously, the hipster crowd as well, don't want to be associated, that the real science is now becoming more of the hipster sort of thing. I don't know how true that is. It has a ring of niceness to it. I like it, but I guess we'll just have to see.
Actually, I think the history is going to look back as the tipping point is the measles outbreak at Disneyland, where everyone's like, no. Because this is terribly classist of me, but my read on the situation was, we don't need those vaccines. We keep our children clean. We are proper middle class, you know, upper middle class white people. Mm-hmm. We do all the right things. We don't need to take the horrible risk of the vaccine because we do everything else right. Vaccines are for lesser people who can't be bothered to clean or eat correctly. And then all of those people got together at Disneyland and all their kids got the measles. And it was like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
I guess this is actually this wasn't just me wanting to feel smarter than everyone else and knowing what's really going on. This is actually what's called a disease.
Yeah.
You might be onto something, Jay. What greater symbol of, I don't know, the middle class or the upper middle class than Disneyland or Disney World?
Yeah, that's a good point. That is true. Now, that's an interesting way to look at it. I had always kind of looked at it in more of an arrogance sort of way that, you know, oh, I'm middle class white and educated and nobody has ever told me that I'm not smart enough and good enough and good looking enough to do absolutely anything I ever want to. Therefore, I'm smarter than all of my doctors. And if something doesn't feel right to me, because my feelings are more important than anything else that exists in the world, also, then therefore I shouldn't do it. And I feel that vaccines are bad, so I'm not going to do them. That was kind of the sort of idea that I had, and hopefully that was being broken. And we started to have more of a reliance again on, you know, evidence and a realization that, gosh, you know, the scientific method was developed for a reason. And that reason is it works. It actually works, you know, as opposed to I ate an apple and an hour later I was sick. It must be the apple. That doesn't work. Anyways, off topic. We really got to close it up. Jay, just enough time to hear the question for next week.
Well, 55 years ago this week, Theodore Maiman demonstrated the world's first laser on, in May of 1960, which validated a few years of theory about how coherent light could be coherent visible light could be generated into a collimated beam. What's interesting, though, is when the concept of what we call lasers today was put together, they didn't call it a laser; they called it something else. What was the you can go and get Bell Labs technical journals with this different term in it describing work leading up to and including the laser. Hmm. So what was the original technical term for what we call a laser today?
That is a great question.
Great.
I was thinking you were going to ask, what does laser stand for? And I'm like, oh, man, I know that light amplification, stimulated emissions, radiation. I know that all thing. But no, this one I don't know. I have no idea. That's a great question. And speaking of science, we got Rob Rigel with Rob Shot First is going to be on momentarily. He's chomping at the bit. He's got his Lenovo out and ready to go, ready to fire it up. So, Jay, Dave, hey, don't forget it's Mother's Day as well for anybody that's listening, and for you two, you know, get on the stick. You can call Groupon though. Groupon's got a $25,000 deal. They'll send a son who's better than you to your mom.
Oh!
If they guarantee it.
That's
guarantee
a really
it.
Low bar.
I thought it was a little pricey. I really, to find a son better than me shouldn't cost more than, I don't know, $150 or so, you know. Anyways, thanks guys, have a great weekend. We will talk soon. That's about it. Take care.
All right, take care, fellas.
Yep,
take care, guys. Bye-bye. Bye.
Dave Sparky Saganaki and Jay Garman. Go to jaygarman.net. You can hear more about him. Find us at facebook.com/techtalk, WRLR. You've been listening to WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. I am going to have a podcast-only song of the week that is truly podcast-only, because I'm going to load you down with listening to some of the great people, companies, and organizations that support us. And so don't go away, though. Robbie Rigel and Rob Shot First is going to be on just a moment.
Shirt. Walked into the room, you know you made my eyes burn. It was like James Dean, for sure. You're so fresh to death and sick as cancer. You said punk rock, I grew up on hip hop. You fit me better than my favorite sweater. And I know that love is mean, and love hurts. But I still remember that day we met in December, oh baby. You.